from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll find out about a new guide to Indiana wineries.
I'll get a preview of, you've waited for it, and here it is, the Internet Cat Video Festival at the IMA.
Meow. And I'll catch up with the Da Vinci Pursuit, plus there'll be that arts calendar we call.
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. With more than 70 wineries now operating in Indiana, wouldn't it be nice to have a guide to them? Well, thanks to Todd and Becky Outcault, we do. Their book, Indiana Wineries, The Ultimate Guide to Wine in Indiana, was recently published, and Travis DiNicola spoke with Todd about the book.
Todd, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm a big fan of wines, and so I was very curious to hear about this book, and I have to just start by asking you, how did you and your wife get so lucky to have the opportunity to write a book on Indiana wines?
Well, we've always enjoyed traveling and tasting wines in other part of the country. For example, we made many wine trips to Napa, Oregon State, Washington State, Michigan. And then we came to the realization about 5 years ago that we visited most of the wineries also in Indiana. And I came up with the idea, well, why don't we write a book about this? We then went back and started photographing and interviewing the winemakers and the winery owners, and eventually just put the book together, and my good friend Tom Doherty at Blue River Press was kind enough to publish this.
That's very cool. So you had not, even though you and your wife have enjoyed traveling and going to wineries, as my wife and I do, but you'd never created a book on wineries before or anything like that?
Not a book. I've written several articles about wines, but I'm not a wine expert. I'm not a sommelier or anything like that. We just enjoy wines. Yeah. We know what we like, and just like to write about what other people enjoy and some of the amenities of wineries as well, not just the wines themselves, but what do the wineries themselves offer.
Sure, because I mean, there's certainly a lot of different ones throughout Indiana and some that have food available or just really great locations, or others that are, you know, above gas stations practically. I mean, there are some. So what I find first, I mean, very interesting is just how many wineries there are now in Indiana. Over 70 that are in your book. Before we went on the air, you mentioned that something like another 10 have opened up since you've published the book. I mean, that's just kind of crazy.
There are always wineries, it seems, opening. There are some smaller ones that, they try to make it. They don't make it. And so the landscape is always changing.
Yeah. Indiana wineries are very interesting, too. I mean, some certainly do grow their own grapes. Others import them from other places. Is that something you talk about in the book?
Absolutely. There are some wonderful estate wineries in Indiana that grow more of the Indiana grapes that we would be accustomed to, like Chamberson, Traminette. For example, Easley, right here in Indianapolis, just recently won an international award for best Traminette. So they're producing some of the best in the world. And likewise, there are other wineries. Huber down south in southern Indiana is the largest estate winery, over 80 acres of vineyard. And then there's others, as you mentioned, that actually don't have their own vines, but they bring wine or juice or grapes in from other parts of the country. So we have wineries here in Indiana that are producing, for example, marvelous Cabernets, Pinot Noirs, Chardonnays that are coming from other parts of the country.
But being produced here. That's kind of an interesting phenomenon, because when you think like, oh, Indiana wines, the first assumption is, well, it must be Indiana grapes. Or same thing when you think of, you know, wines from the Finger Lakes in upstate New York or wines from Michigan. But that does, I mean, that's not something that we necessarily, let's say, hold beers to, that, the wheat has to come from the same state that the brewery is in.
That's correct. And people forget that even in places like Napa Valley, there are many wineries in Napa that don't have their own vines. I mean, mm-hmm. they're bringing in the product from other parts of California or even other parts of the country
sure.
to produce their wines. So it's a level playing field. I mean, if somebody's adept and good at making wines, there are some fantastic winemakers that have actually come from California to work in Indiana. So they're here.
So the 70 or so wineries that you have in your book, you have maps of where to get to them, photographs, descriptions, hours, websites, things like that. How do you have it organized, though? Is it organized more geographically or alphabetically? Or for example, I'm someone who really prefers drier wines, and so I have a hard time sometimes finding Indiana wines that I like. Can I go into an index and find the wineries where I'm going to find some drier wines in here?
How we've laid this out is it's alphabetical order in terms of the wineries themselves, mm-hmm. but in the back of the book, we have an index, which actually breaks the wineries down in terms of regions. So okay. there are five basically major regions that we're looking at as the state. And then beyond that, in each of the wineries that are profiled, we have recommendations that we make about some of the top wines that each of these wineries, in our estimation,
sure.
are producing.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, what they offer. So some wineries maybe only have three or four or five labels, where others have maybe 30 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
It's phenomenal, really, to see some of the lineups that the wineries are producing.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty interesting stuff.
It is.
And I assume there's also information about pricing and things like that.
That's correct.
In the book as well. How have you been to all 70 that are in the book? Is that
I would like
most
to say I've been to all of them.
Uh-huh.
I would say that we have been to all but maybe three or four of them.
Okay.
Even the smallest of wineries. Typically, I would take a day and make a run and mm-hmm. visit four or five wineries at a time. And I would always tell the wineries going in, hey, I'm just going to taste today because
mm-hmm.
I'm going to be on the road. I'm going to the next place. But
right.
I'll taste as many of your wines as you will allow me to taste, and I'll mm-hmm. write a profile about them. And all of the wineries, I never had a single experience where I met someone who was not accommodating and didn't show Hoosier hospitality.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just that way.
Well, and that's one of the great things about doing wine tours and tastings, and whether it's here in Indiana, or, as I mentioned, I've done a number of them in Michigan and in the Finger Lakes. You've done them in Napa and Oregon, Washington, which I'd love to do Washington myself. You know, when you get people, you know, sharing wine and tasting wine, I mean, it's a pretty friendly bunch overall.
It very much is. In fact, I think that's where wine comes into play, that's maybe a little different than beer, in that you really enjoy wine with friendship, with mm-hmm. food, just, you know, conversation. You can drink it at home with good friends. And
I'm not going to ask you to pick your favorite, because I know that's, first of all, it's probably impossible to do. But also, mm-hmm. of course, everyone's taste in wine can be very different. And, you know, I might like a dry, you might like a sweet wine, what have you. But in your course of doing this, were there any wineries that really stood out for you and your wife as being like, wow, I didn't know that we had that in Indiana? Maybe not just the wine, but the location, or something about the experience that, you know, many people, I think, have been down to, you know, Oliver Winery, of course, outside of
sure.
Bloomington, which is a beautiful facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's sort of the go-to one. But there are other ones that you're like, wow, I can't wait to get back there.
There are several. There's a couple of very wonderful wineries in northern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of these are rather relatively new. One of these is 2E's Winery.
Okay.
And they're producing some very unique wines, in that they're bringing in grape from Europe and producing wines along the lines of maybe Cabernets, but also wines that normally you just wouldn't find in Indiana.
Yeah.
And that's one. Huber Winery down south
sure.
is a large, again, as I mentioned earlier, the largest estate winery, but they're also producing some phenomenal blends, some very tasty wines.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, for those, Indiana seems to have more of a sweet taste mm-hmm. in terms of what people generally enjoy. There are so many wines out there, especially along the lines of a Chamberson, Treminette, that people would really enjoy, and you can find those just about in every winery in the state.
You know, one thing that some wineries I know do, and one that I stayed at in upstate New York made available, was basically having a small sort of like bed and breakfast type place or a lodge on the grounds where you could stay overnight, which is a great thing. Are there any wineries like that in Indiana?
There are a few. Mm-hmm. There are a couple down in the Madison area that do have bed and breakfast associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
French Lick is another one where,
sure,
if you, anytime you go to the French Lick Winery, you can obviously stay in the mm-hmm. West Baden Hotel, or there are other bed and breakfasts there. So that's a great destination, a great weekend destination trip. And that's also in the book as well, as we put together some basically weekend excursions that people could enjoy.
Nice. Okay.
And so some recommendations sort of suggested for bed and breakfast and restaurants where people could eat.
Now, I also like to drive in a very enjoyable manner, let's say, on back roads with the top down when the weather is good. Anything about good roads in there? Because there's some great back roads in Indiana for people to try out if they like that type of driving.
Absolutely. And even this time of the year, the fall,
yeah,
especially southern Indiana, you get some great color in there.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that a lot of times it's helpful to visit the winery website to mm-hmm. get directions on how to find the winery, because many of them will say, don't follow the GPS. It will
right.
take you to the wrong location.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to.
A lot of them are
kind
of out of the
search.
Way.
Mm-hmm. You really have to search. And yeah, that's part of the fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
To find them.
It is. Well, it sounds like you and your wife just had a great time working on this book. And sorry that she couldn't be here with us, but I do want to mention, of course, that Todd, that you did this with your wife, Becky. And congratulations on the publication of it. And looking forward to taking some Saturday afternoon drives with your book in hand.
Thank you so much for having me.
Travis DiNicola with Todd Outcalt. Todd and his wife Becky wrote the book Indiana Wineries, The Ultimate Guide to Wine in Indiana, which was recently published by Blue River Press. It's available at bookstores everywhere. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Internet Cat Video Festival was the first celebration of online cat videos when it launched at the Walker Arts Center in 2012. It's a live event that gathers fellow feline fanatics to watch a curated collection of cat clips. And to date, the festival has been in over 150 cities around the world. Why am I dangling these facts like catnip in front of you? Well, the Internet Cat Video Festival is finally coming to the Indianapolis Museum of Art later this month, and Sharon Gamble invited its inventor, Scott Stulen, in for the details.
I remember first reading about a project you did at the Walker and thinking, oh my gosh, that poor man is going to be known forever as that dude who organized the cat video festival. But the flip side of that is, oh my gosh, how cool, that guy is going to be known forever as the person who said this crazy idea that was wildly successful. How did that idea come up at
sure.
the Walker?
And that's true. My Google search returns are ruined forever.
You're going to have to do something.
Something drastic.
Yeah, paradigm shifting.
I hope it's a good thing. But how it came about is a pretty simple idea. So myself and one of my interns at the time, Katie Hill, we thought it'd be interesting to take content that exists mostly on, you know, exclusively online, that you mostly view on your laptop or on your phone by yourself, like a cat video.
Yeah.
And but it's kind of a solitary experience. You may look at it, but then share it with a friend of yours and enjoy it. But it's rarely viewed in together.
Sure.
So it was a simple idea. So what happened if we take that content, make a festival out of it, take it offline, and then invite everybody to come and watch it together? And that was the simple idea of, like, how do we take, like, the internet and make it more social in the real world and take it offline? So cat videos seemed like the obvious subject matter for that. And so we put out the idea, we're going to do the first Internet Cat Video Festival at the Walker. And we kind of snuck it through management to be able to do it.
I love that. Good for you. And did you wait, did you have some sort of highfalutin academic name for it?
We didn't.
Something?
We called it what it was, but it was underneath the, in the kind of context of this open field program we've been doing. It's like kind of a smaller event. And to be completely honest, We thought originally it might be 50 to 100 people that show up. And
sure.
We have a small data projector and maybe a couple of cases of beer, and we call it a day. And then once we put the announcement out there and announced this kind of publicly around 4th of July of that first year in 2012, it went viral in about 3 hours. So we did a blog post, and Gawker picked it up. And we were talking to the LA Times within 4 hours after that, and it just kind of blew up from there. And I think it was a combination of, one, the novelty of putting, like, cat videos aligned with a contemporary art museum.
Yeah.
But I also think it really struck a really positive chord with people, is that there is this passion about this content. People love cats. They love cat videos. And we are kind of, in a way, like, taking it and making it okay for people to come and celebrate that together. And there's a lot of novelty in that. So I think for the media, that was one of the big pieces. And then when the event happened, I think that story shifted a little bit after that.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're also a serious educator and museum guy behind
sure.
this veneer of, ooh, it's fun, fun, fun all the time. So you talked about something there I'd like you to expand on a little
sure.
bit, which is to, and this is a more radical idea than it seems on the surface, to take a dynamic from an era when we're alone a lot with our digital devices
yep.
and to see if you can interrupt that in a way.
Well, I think there's a kind of a – the cat video thing, it becomes a little bit of a thread through all the work that I do
mm-hmm.
in the museum context. And one of those things is, how do we get people to slow down? How do we get people to stop and actually look at something
mm-hmm.
and experience it? And how to have it and experience it doesn't have to be mediated through our digital technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, an interesting that came from the Cat Video Festival is not only was it taking, like, this digital content and putting it into more of a social environment, but the one unique thing that happened that we didn't really anticipate is that, you know, a lot of concerts you go to nowadays, everybody's taping it so they can put it on Facebook and, like, taking photos of themselves there. Like, they need to prove that they're at the event. and it becomes a very annoying experience, I find, at least, at a
sure.
lot of those events. This, people weren't doing that because all that content's online already. There's no need to put Little Bub back on online because it's already there. And so people kind of put their phone away, and they're really kind of in the moment. And that was, I think, kind of a revelation in this, is that there's something about people actually. And I think the other kind of important angle about it is, like, not only that, but when a museum does something like this, you typically expect it to be either, like, from a critical lens, like it's going to be
sure.
from that angle, or it's going to be somewhere done kind of ironically and maybe kind of like kind of hipster irony, say, with things like this.
Yeah.
But we didn't do it in either one of those ways. We truly, like, embraced this and, like, you know, I like cat videos. I love cat videos. I like the idea of this. And we were doing it very sincerely. And I think at the core of this, it was about, can we have a moment where we can kind of put all that aside and just enjoy each other, enjoy what we're seeing, and basically bring this joy piece back into it. And for me, that's a big piece of art. And it's a big piece of culture. There should be an element of enjoyment and joy in that. And we can have things that I think challenge us and that should challenge us too. But I think there is this other element of joy. And I think what this did is it created a vehicle for that to happen. We kind of created a platform and people filled it. And for me, that is kind of the platform when I look at a lot of other work that I've done in museums, is like, how do we create a platform for an experience to happen and invite people to come and take that over? And we don't necessarily know where it's going to go. And I think that was part of this, why it was so magical, is it went in a place that we never expected. And some of the best programs are something where you're kind of taking a chance and it goes someplace kind of magical.
And it's not a typical museum experience where I expect to go in to maybe rent the headset for a curated tour,
right.
to read the labels that tell me what to think about this painting or in the case of a good museum like the IMA, that challenge me about
right.
what to think about this painting. But the traditional fine art museum experience is often kind of pre-digested.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is a little bit with, you know, not only, you know, with the cat video things, maybe an extreme end on one end of that, but finding ways where it isn't such a linear experience. I think often museums will talk about participation or interaction,
mm-hmm.
but it's very predetermined. Like, they know where you're going to start, and eventually they know where you're going to end, because it really, you're kind of just going along the path and playing through the steps. I'm far more interested, and I think it's a lot of things that we're doing at the IMA, that we're actually just setting up a scenario, and we actually don't know where it's going to go.
Hmm.
And for museums, often that's the scary thing, because you don't know what's going to happen.
What are some of the challenges or fears you've heard?
Well, I think it's just that it's different. It's different than how people, museums tend to work in a way that's very predictable. Mm-hmm. They like to have things that are well thought, presented in a certain way, that the design is controlled, the interaction is controlled. Obviously, there's a quality control in that I'm very conscious of and sure. aware of as well. But it's also that they want to make sure that you know, chance is something that in a typical museum environment and process is not something that really is embraced. They like to have something that feels very predetermined, and we don't want to know that somebody is going to do a behavior in there that feels like very out of place in that environment. So there's a practical part of that, mm-hmm. but I think it's also just a means of thought. And like this is, you know, kind of where I'm coming at a lot of these things is how do we challenge some of that? And you know, maybe we're setting up a scenario where it's not going to work. And I think failure is a big part of that. And there's also a resistance that, you know, in a museum environment, we should have everything figured out and we don't want to present our failures to the public.
You're the experts.
Correct.
Yeah.
And there's an authority in all of that, too.
Yeah.
And in a certain way, you know, with this is we're giving and ceding some authority to our audience and to the public. And we're also saying that we maybe don't know the answer to this. And we also are saying that at times, like, this isn't going to work. And I think those are things that until very recently museums have not embraced. But, of course, it's part of life. It should be. I mean, I think art and life should be, you know, meshed with one another. And what's more a part of life than failure? So,
what? I'm shocked to hear this.
So I think in ways it's setting out a scenario like this that feels far more kind of real to people. And they feel like they're actually part of creating that experience. And I think for me, too, is I want to have an experience for an audience that they're opting into, that they don't feel forced into it. They're not coerced into it. But it's an experience that they're actually choosing to be part of. But also they can choose to be as invested or not. You know, a big part of, like, coming back to even the Cat Video Festival, there is an audience that's actively participating in the event that may be dressing up, that may be submitting a cat video, that might be involved in that mm-hmm. way. There's also this much larger audience that actually is watching the people that are watching the cat videos. And I think that's the other thing is thinking about that as participation too. So whenever we're doing an event, a good chunk of the audience isn't an active participant, but they're a participant in watching other people participate. And they actually do enjoy watching other people participate.
Yeah.
And I think it's also finding a space for that too.
And the other kind of sneaky thing about the using cat videos as the platform for this shared experience is it's not particularly political.
Correct.
You know, it's
correct.
Pretty safe. There's people, little tiny people and ancient people who all love watching cats do silly things.
Yeah, I like to say it's about as universal a subject as it gets.
Yeah.
And I think it also, like, even, I mean, kids and babies are probably those two. You can kind of, pets and kids, babies, things like that.
Yeah.
But the one thing that's nice about, you know, that truly is about cat videos is that it's very universal. And I think it transcends language. So the Cat Video Festival has now been in, I think, over a dozen different countries, including several countries where it is in English, where English is not the first language. And it transcends that. Some of the videos that we get for submissions are from all over Russia. They're from all over Japan, Australia. It is this international phenomenon and an international passion. And I think partly because of that, there is something that really is truly core about this that we enjoy. You know, we enjoy our pets. We enjoy watching our pets. And there is something very universal about human nature, about kind of looking for human traits in animals. And I think that's a lot of what the cat videos are about,
oh,
too,
yeah.
is really applying human traits to the cats.
So on behalf of my co-host and as well as another colleague, big cat fans, I think among us we own, I don't know, something like 15, those three people. Full disclosure, I have to ask about a local celebrity who's going to make an appearance. There may be listeners who don't know who Lil Bub is. So explain Lil Bub and let's talk about.
Sure. So we do have a local, Bloomington, Indiana local, celebrity cat. And yes, there are celebrity cats in the world. It's become a thing within the – and it's funny that it's become a thing even since the first Cat Video Fest we did in 2012. It was kind of just the start of this kind of idea of the celebrity cat.
That's about the time Grumpy Cat started gaining
Grumpy
traction.
Grumpy Cat was just after that. And Lil Bub was at our first Cat Video Festival. So Mike Bub's dude, as he describes himself brought Bob Shi out to the event and was there. And actually Vice, the media company, was there shooting a documentary with Bub, and that's why they were there. But it was amazing to see when, like, Bub arrived and this, like, you could see the crowd just kind of start flowing
aww.
Like over to her. And So explaining who Bub is. So Bub is actually a kitten that has several different genetic disabilities, and very, very unique because of that. She has about three different unique genetic things that are, I think it really makes her about only the one and only one in the world that is truly like her. But she's has feline dwarfism. Mm-hmm. So because of it, she's basically a perma kitten. Kind of maintains kitten traits even though in an adult cat. And so she's become a celebrity online due to these kind of very adorable photographs, videos. And then Mike, who owns a recording studio down in Bloomington, it's been really interesting watching the path there, too, because he's taken this fame of his cat that he didn't seek out. It kind of came to him, but has embraced it and has started a fund for Bubs, a Little Bubs Big Fund, which supports special needs animals.
Aww.
And has raised thousands of dollars through that fund. And it really has been able to balance this charitable aspect of it with also the kind of the weird phenomenon of a celebrity cat. And so I think I've been fortunate to be able to create relationships with a lot of these celebrity cat people. And I know that's
we're gonna
it feels
have to
like
coin
so surreal.
It's up to you to coin a term for that.
Yeah, I don't know. and I think at times, like for me, kind of looking back at it now, it's kind of been in such a very surreal place. And you know, one story also that probably is the most surreal of it is that I was at South by Southwest a couple of years ago presenting on the Cat Video Festival, and in the green room, Seth Meyers was there. Formerly from Saturday Night Live and now talk show host Mark Cuban was in the room at the other table.
Oh my gosh.
The Game of Thrones cast is sitting behind us, and I'm
what
sitting with
assemblage.
You know, Grumpy Cat on my computer before we're going to go on stage. And all anybody wanted to do is get their photo with Grumpy Cat. So it is a very unique world. And I think it's also the followers of, you know, the Cat Video Festival or Celebrity Cats are incredibly passionate about it. They come dressed in costume. They follow every movement of this. And they also are some of the most charitable people that I've met. And one of the things when we put the Cat Video Festival in place is that we did make one requirement when it toured, is that it needed to be in partnership with another animal welfare organization, nonprofit, and we wanted to have it hosted, if at all possible, with a cultural institution. So it's, for the most part, maintained that throughout so that it is being screened in art museums and cultural centers and not necessarily in, you know, regular commercial theaters, so that it's maintained this kind of charitable focus throughout. And, you know, Little Bub's a big piece of that. And so it's nice to have my relationship with Bub, and it's the first time they've actually done an event in Indianapolis. So it's a big deal kind of bringing them up here, and we're going to be doing a meet and greet on both days, and then Bub's going to be on stage and help introduce the films as well.
Sharon Gamble with I'm a Curator of Audience Experiences and Performances, Scott Stulen. You can take part in the museum's Cat Video Festival screening with special guest Little Bub November 20th and 21st. The festival features 85 cat videos spanning 75 minutes. And the reel is created specifically for the festival and not available online, so you can only see it there. Get your tickets and learn more about the festival and the special meet and greet with Permakid and Little Bub at imamuseum.org. Meow.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
What kind of wine goes with cat food?
With cat food?
Wait, let's consult the Indiana Wine Guide.
What a great idea.
I love it. And that'll give our listeners a chance to think about what they're going to do in the next couple of weeks. We've got some inspiration on our calendar we call
What'll We Mew? You really enjoyed the cat video interview, didn't you?
As you and I were discussing, that conversation was surprisingly deep at times.
Mm-hmm. Well, my cats like fish and shrimp. That's their favorite usually.
Oh, yum.
So I would say maybe a nice...
nice dry white wine.
A dry white, I'm thinking. Yeah. Maybe like a Pinot Grigio.
Pinot Grigio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that'd be good. Yeah, I've never actually sampled their cat food. I'm just happy when I can have a glass of wine without cat fur in it.
Yeah, no kidding. Mm-hmm. Same thing applies at my house.
Yes.
What do you have this week?
Well, it is not too early to start thinking about flipping the switch for the service. Circle of Lights. And again, there is a coloring contest for kids of all ages, or at least 3 to 12, who can enter the Carson's Coloring Contest to find out if you can get a scholarship and also get a chance to flip the switch when they light the world's largest Christmas tree on the circle right after Thanksgiving. Entries are due by November 16th. You can pick up the coloring form at Carson's, or you can also get it online through Downtown Indy, and it's also available in the Indianapolis Star as well. So make sure that those artists out there are coloring their submission forms.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love it. Hey, you, if you're a regular listener, you might remember my conversation with Dr. Jim Glass, who is going to give a talk this coming Monday evening at the Riviera Club. It's free. Come at 7 o'clock for coffee or tea. And the talk begins at 7:30. The topic is Roman and Renaissance architecture. And Dr. Glass is also going to talk about some influences right here in Indianapolis of Roman and or Renaissance architecture. So that's coming up on Monday evening again, coffee and tea at 7, and the talk at 7:30, absolutely free, at the Riviera Club, which is at 5640 North Illinois Street.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's still time to sign up for the Holiday Herb Workshop down at Garfield Park. It's presented through the Central Indiana Herb Society from 10 to 11 Saturday morning on the 7th. It's only $5, and you can learn how to make holiday gifts using herbs from your garden.
Wow.
Yeah, which sounds like a really neat thing to do. Always great things going on down there. Of course, they're getting ready for their conservatory crossing, which opens right after Thanksgiving, when there'll be lots of holiday decorations and trains.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
We know you like trains.
Yes.
Not to extend the cat theme too far, but you really can't swing a cat these days without...
You shouldn't
swing
a cat.
Don't worry, we really don't swing cats.
No.
None of the cats in our respective lives is ever picked up and swung.
No.
Yeah.
But
bats are another subject. But you can't swing a cat, to use the expression, this week without hitting one of the Spirit and Place Festival
events.
That's
true. There's so much going
on all
over
town. The theme this year is Dream. You can go to spiritandplace.org and plan your attack, and you'll really need to so you can get all the events that you want to attend in. A reminder that one of those events is going on this very Sunday evening at the Jazz Kitchen. Gail Payne is doing her cabaret show called Let
Great.
It Shine.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And she's doing her show a couple of times at 5:45 and 7. And you can go online to the Jazz Kitchen and check those out. And you might as well plan on having dinner there as well.
That sounds like a great idea.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Love their pasta. Okay, so the IRT is, of course, bringing back A Christmas Carol, and they are bringing back Scrooge Gives Back as part of that, because the performances of Christmas Carol open on November 14th, but on November 13th, you can donate blood, food, or toys at the IRT and receive a ticket to A Christmas Carol. And if you stop in at the IRT on November 13th, at any time during the day, and bring those things, you can do a blood drive from 3 to 7, toy donation from 11 to 6, or food donation from 11 to 6, all in the lobby of the IRT, and get your free ticket to A Christmas Carol. Very cool thing to do.
Overachievers can do all three of those things.
I suppose you
just
could.
Just saying. Hey, Butler Theater Department is doing a new production this weekend, next weekend, of Thornton Wilder's Our Town.
I saw that. How
yeah.
cool.
And
I
it's,
love that play.
It's, you know, and one of the great tests of that script is how many different ways it can be interpreted. And the Butler folks have been up to a fresh new reading of that show. So you can check that out on Butler's website, Butler Theater.
Very cool. Hey, the Indiana State University, in collaboration with the Candles Holocaust Museum and Education Center, is doing a whole week of lectures, music, dramatic performances, exhibits, and films during the Night of Broken Glass, remembering the Holocaust from November 9th through the 14th. And they are having lots and lots of events for their students, but this is all as well open to the public. As I mentioned, performances, concerts, lectures, too many to go into here. But if you do go to the their website at indstate.edu/night, you can find an event. All the events they are doing are free and open to the public through this week. Again, it's November 9th through the 14th, Night of Broken Glass, Remembering the Holocaust at Indiana State University.
Fantastic. You know, The Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra has a fabulous cellist coming in on Saturday, November 21st. I know it seems a little bit early to be thinking about that, but that'll be here before you know it. Her name is Ingbal Segev, and she's going to do the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1, also on the program, Beethoven Symphony No. 2, and the Korngold Dance in the Old Style. You don't get to hear Korngold played by orchestra very often. Guest conductor Kelly Kuo is on the podium, and you can learn more about that at icomusic.org. That's, once again, Saturday, November 21st.
Author and journalist Tracy Kidder is going to be here at University of Indianapolis, which is really cool, on November 12th. He will be here speaking. His books include Mountains Beyond Mountains and The Soul of a New Machine. It is a free event and starts at 7 o'clock at Schwitzer Student Center at the UND Hall there at the University of Indianapolis campus. And what a cool thing to be able to hear him speak.
Indeed. Next weekend is going to get considerably louder in our town. You know why?
Why?
The 40th anniversary of Bands of America Grand National Championships. 11 Indiana bands among the 94 high school ensembles competing for America's national champion title. 3 days of performances, November 11th through the 14th. And just so many great performances you can hear. You can learn more by going online to Bands of America and, again, plan your schedule.
Modus Dance is back with a new performance next weekend on the 13th and 14th of November called Maze. Maze is a tango with identity, a puzzle of perspective, a date with distraction.
Wow.
Yes, 7 innovative Modus choreographers are going to take you through a labyrinth of modern dance that will encompass an entire year of new work through neural pathways, internal circuitry, and connections.
What?
I love the descriptions.
Wow.
Yes. So this is Maze, an evening of dance from Modus Dance. And again, it's next Friday and Saturday, the 13th and 14th, at the White Rabbit Cabaret in Fountain Square.
Where dance meets science, apparently. Wow. Hey, here's something. The deadline isn't coming up for a little while on this, but I wanted to give you the heads up. If you are an artist in one of the following areas, crafts, design, media arts, photography, visual arts, or folk arts, you're invited to think about applying for an Indiana Arts Commission individual artist project grant. And you can find out more at, are you ready? in.gov/arts/individual-artist-program, or just Google Indiana Arts Commission individual artist grants.
That's a little bit easier.
That'll get you there as well.
There you go. Well, we will be back next week, and you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us on that calendar we call
What Do We Mew?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
The Da Vinci Pursuit is an organization that makes connections with science and art with unique projects throughout Indianapolis. Their annual event, Let's Get Curious, is coming up on November 12th. To learn more, Travis DiNicola spoke with Mark Kiesling, founder and CEO of The Da Vinci Pursuit.
Mark, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Good to see you too, Travis.
Yeah, thank you. You've got a fun event coming up. The Let's Get Curious event, second year you've done it, new location. I want to hear all about that in just a moment. But before we do that, tell me a bit about Da Vinci Pursuit, because it's a really cool organization doing some interesting work here in town.
Well, thanks. We, as you know, bring together artists and scientists,
mm-hmm.
and they work with community. And we basically try to create the city as a science museum, using the arts to do that. So it's a concept of thinking of the museum without walls.
I love that. I love the idea, too, of sort of exploring science through the art, but doing it out in the community.
Right. And well, it seemed to make infinite sense to put it in the community for a variety of reasons. But one, shouldn't we take what we think of arts and culture, shouldn't it be actually where people are?
Mm-hmm.
And that they encounter it there. And that doesn't negate the need for great museums and that kind of thing. But
sure.
At the same time,
We need a lot more of trying to engage the public itself in learning about science, but the arts are an awesome way to, in which to do that.
Give me some examples of some of the work that you guys have done.
Yeah, so we, the most recent really cool thing that we've got up are two kabikoscopes.
Kabikoscopes.
Yes.
I love that word.
Which you pedal a fixed bicycle, and it turns bicycle wheels at 18 feet up in the air that have color gels in them and create a kaleidoscope on the ground, and it encourages fitness and health and well-being.
And they're just cool and fun.
Very cool and fun.
One's down in Fountain Square.
Well, both of them are there. They create a gateway.
They're both down there together. Okay, sorry.
On Pleasant Run and Barth Avenue, so it's the South Parkway, just off of, as you go down Shelby. And it's the gateway drawing you over to Garfield Park along there.
Yeah.
And part of a big redevelopment effort in that whole thing, there's a new performance venue with seats and an amphitheater. And then we also have just installed also in that location what we have been working with the city and the Arts Council on, which are called art ports, which are an infrastructure in the ground that will allow us to pop up art as we put more of these around the city with a universal post that can go down in. So an artist can create, so long as the post will dock with that port in the ground, it means they can get past having to have any kind of permitting or to drill in the ground and do that.
That's very cool. So it's sort of almost like creating temporary permanent public art.
Yes.
That it allows for that to be easier to do because, I mean, a lot of public art that's outside, well, one, as you mentioned, you have to deal with permits, but two, how do you make it secure so that it doesn't blow over or get stolen or get moved? And so this sounds like if you dock it in the proper way and it's done in the right way, it makes it easier for artists to do that?
Right, yeah. And so what we'll do is we give the specification for the bottom of that post has to fit, you know, has to be certain length and go down in there. And it can't be, you know, some regulations on how tall, you know, so it doesn't torque it out of the ground, although these things are pretty, really strong. But they're concreted in. They're with rebar. They go down about 5 feet deep.
What a great idea.
Yeah. So our thought was you could pop up anything. You know, we've been, so we're going to about to put another two in Broderpool. What we, you know, our ultimate goal would be thinking about how do I activate all over the city, all the cultural districts, how do I create these ways of any artist being able to put something in the ground,
you know,
and have it up.
It doesn't sound like a lot, but I've worked with, you know, a couple of artists over the years on different public art projects, and the two things that are always the most challenging, one are the permits, and two, how do you make sure that the work is going to be secure and safe?
Exactly.
You know, and it doesn't sound like a big deal, but it can often be an enormous hurdle.
Right. It's a huge hurdle. And so when we were looking at how do we, you know, we were working with our artists, and even in the best of conditions and working with really a great city administration was, you know, receptive to everything, but it can still take even 9 months in the best of circumstances. That just doesn't allow somebody who's even wanting to prototype.
Right.
But we came up with, you know, the thought that you could do art ports.
Yeah. That's so cool.
And so that's another one that we just did. And now we're going to showcase in our evening event, which will be this year at Orchard School.
Yes.
On the 12th.
Coming up
November,
on the 12th from
Thursday,
6 to 8.
6 to 8. And we'll showcase six of our artists who are working with funding from the Kresge Foundation through Roe Reconnecting the Waterways.
Yes. You've been on at different points, we've talked about this project, the Reconnecting Our Waterways, because there's a lot of different neat things that are going on with it in terms of different sort of art projects that are also ways of, even in one case, sampling the water and getting data on the water, right?
Right, correct.
And so those artists are going to be featured in your event next week.
That's right. And so you'll see things from a great giant water bottle that Phil Campbell has made out of, I won't say how many exactly, but over 1,000 water bottles that were retrieved from the river, showing he glued them all together into a giant water bottle that has a boat anchor and it'll float in the water. And we can take it and put it in different waterways. And it just gives you an idea that, you know, that small actions of one individual casting their bottle aside adds up to something big. And then that's coupled with Jim Poyser, who works with Urquhart, is building, and also an artist. He's building out of soda straws is a big problem with all of, you know, rivers and waterways. And so he's building straw bales that you can sit on and observe the river from your bale. But he's also on a campaign to get restaurants to quit ubiquitously giving you a straw without you asking.
Right, right.
Because they do create a huge problem in our waterways. And then we have some really sophisticated pieces, Clyde Pennington, our artist, has got tubes that you can look through to see things that are focused along waterways, and then big picture frames. People will be able to play with those. And then each of the artists is also going to bring something just to play with. So it's a fundraising evening, not fund, although we hope to raise dollars that evening.
Sure.
But it is about you having fun.
Yeah, and what's really neat about this event is it's not just a exhibit, to be clear on that. It's very interactive. I mean, the artists are there. They basically have different stations or areas set up, and you can go to each one and take as much or as little time as you want with each one, meet the artists, talk to them about their projects. But but each of them has something very interactive that they're doing that gets people engaged, right?
Right. And I know this weekend coming up at the IMA that the Big Tent people are debuting their big performance venue, which is an eight surround screens and eight channels of sound.
Okay.
But they're also going to be in the centerpiece of ours with a performance at this. So people get to have an intimate experience of actually having their light hors d'oeuvres and drinks inside the Big Tent.
Oh, cool.
With things that we're doing, images and music surrounding them.
And again, your event for Da Vinci Pursuit, Let's Get Curious, taking place on November 12th from 6 to 8 at the Orchard School. If people want to get tickets, they can go to thedavincipursuit.com to get those tickets, right, and get more information as well.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about a little bit more about this Waterways Project, because this has been quite a big event for you. I mean, a lot of artists involved in this over the past few months, some big grants and some really interesting work.
Well, you know, the concept really started when I think really Sherry Bossing from Lilly, and you'll remember her from the idea of Day of Service work, got together with a bunch of people in the city, artists and scientists and people that were there, about 10 of us, and we started to meet and think about how we could develop the science of a better city. And it fell out that the waterways, six of which are in Indianapolis, which is a lot, and encompass 85% of the population of Indianapolis. But that we'd kind of turned our backs. We turned them into sewers. And so the concept we really
pleasant
had was—
Pleasant Run is not usually very pleasant.
Not pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we build these, we try to use the arts to activate those neighborhoods and for people to start caring. And we're really seeing a huge difference as these art installations go in. Another part of that was that we were able, through that initiative, to get with Butler a National Science Foundation grant with Mary Miss, putting in five major installations that you can put yourself into the environment and see that. And so we're doing research on that and studying that as well.
That was the piece I referred to earlier in terms of that it's not actually – it's not just a really cool sort of science and art piece, but it's actually practical in that you're gathering data.
Right. Because we don't know. We really don't know. Everybody, we don't know a lot about how public art and how people actually interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what we get is anecdotal, or we get body counts. There's been really no strong primary research on that when we put public art out, and particularly when it has a more deep meaning in terms of the science content. We really don't know how people
learn.
Does
it actually make a difference?
Right. And so what we borrow is we borrow from art museums and botanical gardens and other museums that are in a controlled environment. But what happens when we put these things in a completely uncontrolled environment without any supervision? We really don't know. And so that's why the National Science Foundation was really interested, was how do you go about doing that? And then secondarily, can that be replicated in other cities? Can the successes that we learn? So that's exciting. Our particular thing with Da Vinci Pursuit is looking at how do artists and scientists then come together. It's not magic. How do they learn to communicate and talk? And so our research is really looking at how do they come to a common language and dialogue that leads to true collaboration between the artist and the scientist versus the artist interpreting something the scientist wants, which we've all seen. You know, illustrations is a good example.
Sure.
Or how does, you know, the artist look at something and then the scientist goes, oh, there's some science in there. This is by intent to do it together.
And showing that there are so many connections in the process. I mean, whether it's artistic work or science, experimentation is a big part of the process. And in the end, both the artist and the scientist are just trying to understand their world and use the tools that they have, whether those tools are arts or sciences, to be able to then describe that world and explain what their research shows to other people.
That's right. And you know, when they sound like it's normal for everybody to think this, but what we're finding is that what's common to the artist and the scientist is creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And most people really don't actually think of scientists as being creative individuals. But that's probably because in school they were learning the scientific method and it was this methodology, which is what happens after you have an idea.
Right.
But the idea that you're going to go after to do research in the first place is incredibly whimsical, very much the same way that an artist comes to, you know, thinking of, well, what am I going to create in wood or in paint?
Yeah.
It's the same process. And so,
you have to have imagination to come
absolutely.
Up with
and so we find that these creative individuals often have also the same things where they're on the fringe of society sometimes in terms of we think of geeks and nerds and we call artists artsy-fartsy and, you know, that kind of thing. But why is that? Well, that's because they actually both see the world differently than everybody else does. And sometimes they get made fun of because they see it differently. But the problems that we're going to see in the future and we're seeing now are going to take those kinds of individuals who can think that way
and solve problems creatively,
whether
it's through the arts
and
or the
see it differently because our you know, normal solutions may not be working.
Mark, very cool work that you're doing through DaVinci Pursuit. And I certainly encourage people to check out the DaVinciPursuit.com website, where not only can you learn more about the event next week, the Let's Get Curious Night at Orchard, but also about all the different projects you're working on, where they're located in the city, and how to get more involved.
Right, and we'd love to see you at the event, but also just have your involvement as we go forward.
Great. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Mark Kiesling, founder and CEO of the DaVinci Pursuit. Their event, Let's Get Curious, takes place on November 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Orchard School. And you can get more information at thedavincipursuit.com, thedavincipursuit.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about the Women's Chorus Fall Concert and their new music director.
I'll find out what's on the Indiana Humanities bookshelf.
Speaking of books, I'll chat with Dan Carpenter about his new collection of poems, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.